welcome. Thank you very much for agreeing to be one of my latest interviewee. Can you introduce yourself, please, and take it from there?
Yeah, I'm Mel Boyle. Hopefully quite a few of you out there will know me in the real world. I've been basically with different companies. I've been an odds compiler, I've been a bookmaker, standing up and in shops and all sorts of things. I've also been the racing correspondent for the Church of England, but that's something we'll go into in a moment. But yeah, 64 years rising, and it seems a long time ago since I vaulted the walls of Alexandra Park over 50 years ago. But it's been a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll bring some amusing little stories for you, which are all true, and might just give you a bit of advice, and hopefully take you from there. So we're at a stage now, rising 64, as I say, where I'm coming to the end of my 17-year run with The Spalding Life. I've written 6,000 columns nearly during the course of 17 years for The Life, which I've been privileged to serve on a freelance basis. But I literally worked every day for many, many years, until a few years ago they cut it down to 3 days a week. And that was fine because I was putting other things in. I also worked for GG.com, which you probably know, and GG's.co.uk, and I'm still with them. As well as doing a lot on Twitter, I try and give as much free information as I can, never believing to charge too much if I charge anything at all. And that's where I think popularity has come in for my sort of work, because I like to think I'm one of the punters still, and that's the way I work. So going back as a 10-year-old, why did I get involved in racing? Living with an uncle, I guess, who was racing mad, and he had the television Saturday afternoons. And it didn't matter what anyone else wanted to watch, that was what was on. And it went from there, really, and I took interest straight away. And it went right through school. During the French lesson, I was listening to Precipice Wood win the Ascot Gold Cup one day. That didn't go down too well. And basically, I left school as a 13, 14-year-old. I wasn't exactly expelled, but we just decided to go our own separate ways. And it was then that I started washing cars. A friend of mine had his mum and dad had a car, which not everybody did in those days. And yeah, I started to make a reasonable living so I could go and fund my racing. And as a 15-year-old, I used to stand outside race courses asking for decent looking people to make sure I could get in. The walls were a bit too high then. And it all went from there, really. And so when it came to working, I started working in betting shops in 1974. So we're talking, well, a long time ago. And it was 4 years until I met up with a chap called Lindsay Scott Patton. We got on very well straight away, and we bought our own shop on the Great West Road. And it was in amongst the sort of shops that we managed for a small company in West London. And we thought we'd do all right. But it turned out that we were right on the Great West Road. If you know London at all, it was right opposite Brentford Nylons. And that Great West Road served as a river. It was like the Mississippi to people. I know they thought crocodiles were going to come swimming by, but they didn't want to come to us. And that was the end of that venture. Lindsay decided he didn't want to go back to work for bookmakers. And he learnt the knowledge, still knowing well today. And he became a black taxi driver. But I went straight back into the shops and went from there, really. But as I was working in different shops, I was working for Mecca at one stage. And I started to get involved in the theory, really, of what people were backing. And it became very aware to me one very frosty Monday when the racing all got cancelled. We'd had a busy Saturday. The weather didn't turn funny until the Sunday. And I was sitting there by myself, basically. It was one Greyhound meeting in the afternoon, like you often got in those days. And I went through all the bets. And I decided to see how much punters were influenced by the racing that was on the television, rather than what they particularly fancied. And it turned out the 1,500 bets or something we did on the Saturday, 83% of them included one of the races, and there were only four in those days on ITV, 83% of the bets had at least one horse involved in those races. And it soon became clear to me, like it is now, really, things haven't really changed, that punters are manipulated very easily. There was a football match the other day, and it works the same way there, the Brighton-Southampton game on the South Coast. And if that game hadn't been on television, I'd wager that the bookmakers wouldn't have taken 5% of what they probably did, we're that badly influenced by what we can see. It's not particularly what we fancy in terms of horses, greyhounds, football teams, but it's what we're influenced by, well, what's live that we can get our buzz from. But of course, the bookmakers lap that up. And it's that type of advice that I would pass on as much as I can, is to go with your flow. If you can't see the race, if you're only relying on terrestrial TV, keep the money in your pocket. Don't get manipulated by bookmakers and the TV channels, who sometimes seemingly work together in taking the money out of your pocket, because that's the quickest way to the poorhouse. Yeah, so we were getting involved with some colourful characters in those days. Another one came along out of the blue, really. He bought a local betting shop when I used to live in Oxfordshire, and became interested when he knew how much I knew about the business and whatever. But I became very interested in him because something didn't seem to be quite right. There was money, but there wasn't money, if you follow my meaning. And what I found out later on in life, I think, was that his in-laws suffered a defeat when he started buying betting shops, etc. The money wasn't his, as far as I'm aware. Taxman wanted to know, but we had one hilarious visit to the teletext service people, who I didn't know where they were in those days, but they were behind what was Earl's Court, which of course has disappeared since, but it was around that way in London. And Andrew could talk his way out of a paper bag, and we went in there, massive organisation, no money in his pocket, no money in the chequebook, no money in anything. And he got the service of teletext up and running before we left the building. He could make people do things that you could never believe. It only lasted 2 weeks, this venture. I was running soccer odds, as it was called. And we were running it out of my bedroom. And laying odds here, there and everywhere. I don't think anybody won or lost at the end. But basically, this thing just crashed around him, where he thought he could make a quick buck out of my bedroom and out of teletext, and it all went badly wrong. And the last thing I knew about it was that HMRC, were hot on his tail. But this was just another one of the many people that were colourful characters, but it couldn't last, and he was just another one of them. During this time, in 1990, my son was born, first child. And it came to pass that her in-laws decided I should get a proper job. And strange enough, I've always been a man of faith. We are people of faith. We're not people of religion as such, but we are people of faith. And job came along in the Church of England. And I worked there. I started in the post room, basically, because things were quite poor. It's very hard to get a proper job when you've been dealing with the likes of the Power Organisation and people like this. Anyway, cut long story short, I started in the post room, but within a year I was assistant manager of the Church of England bookshop in Westminster. Cut long story short, other things came along. I started getting to be really involved then with the Tote, and I got some work with them, but as a freelance, as an advisor to them to a degree. And this office job came up upstairs in Church House. This is the very centre, the epicentre of the Church of England. And I was doing some marketing work out there with the team. But in the meantime, I'd started the sporting life work as well. So I was having to write my column daily. And I said, when I took on this job, look, I'm going to have to do this and whatever. And it had hilarious consequences, because bishops and people like this were shown up into our office. And I was shown as the racing director of the Church of England. We had a guy there who's head of marketing director, if you like, of the Church of England, Dr. Bill Beaver, an American man. Lovely guy, had all the time in the world for people who wanted to work. He knew that I did my work, but I just had other work to do. And when he was showing people around, I was just in the line, and he didn't try and hide the fact. And the bishops just came behind me and said, "What on earth is going on here, Bill?" And he said, well, his answer was, stock answer was, well, who's in charge of the Church of England? Isn't it your queen? Bearing in mind that he's American, your queen's in charge of the Church of England. And she's the First Lady of Racing as well. So if it's all right with her, it's all right with me. Yeah, so we've touched on the Mecca business, and really the interest in the way punters started making their selections, their stakes, just increased and increased. And I wanted to learn more about the business. Odds compiling came after I sent a letter to Corals, their head office. This was pure chance. I wrote to them stating all the stats and facts, which are available now, plentiful, but there weren't many in those days. And I could tell them exactly how many matches Villa have had at home the last 5 years, how many had won, drawn, or lost. And in those days, that sort of information wasn't easy. It was easy for me because I marked it down each and every match. And it soon I had the same sort of opinion about the Greyhound tracks and racing. And to cut a long story short, they took me on as an odds compiler. Now, I was very fortunate in as much as I learned craft what I already didn't know from Joe Fagin, who was the biggest or the best known odds compiler there was. And he was the best. It was simple as that. It was generally known in the trade that he was the best. And he was my mentor to a degree. And it went from there. And football is a good place for you to start if ever you're interested in compiling odds yourself. Because we've got a three-runner race, basically, before all the the first goal scorers and all the rest of it. Just try marking up a game, if you like. And the way I do it is to look at the draw first. The draw's the place to start, really, because very few people back the draw. And consequently, you can be out by a margin in the draw, and it's not going to affect you too badly. You try and get out by the same margin backing favourites or outsiders in football matches, and you'll soon be taken to task. But the draw is the place to start. So if you're backing in a three-horse field like that, you're looking at, these days, the margins are tight, so you're probably looking at around 5% in terms of what the bookmakers are expecting you to make on the game. So if you decide that a 2-1's about the right price for that, you're taking 33.3% out of the market. And then you've got the rest of the SP, basically, to work out as to how strong you feel one side or the other is. And that's the place to start, really. In terms of greyhounds, it's much the same, only there's biases here. Not as much as there used to be in the old days when you had turf tracks. Walthamstow was a wonderful example. wet, rainy night on the grass there, and traps 5 and 6s used to come in like, well, you can't believe. And it's much the same the other way reversed in White City down those days, which I did a lot of my training on. You wanted the inside traps on during the summer, and you couldn't really go too far wrong. So horse racing and greyhound racing and football are a good way to educate yourself. Now, I do a lot of work on Twitter, and I'd be quite happy for people to ask me on a private message on Twitter. It's Malcolm Boyle, simple as that, or Mal Boyle, and I can send you lots of information. If you want it, it's all free, and we can go from there. But I would hope it would be a bit of advice that you might use. And I'm passing on the advice from a past master. I don't know where Joe is now. I presume he's still in Glasgow somewhere. But he knew everything there was to know, and I'm forever grateful for him.
So as well as greyhounds, horses and football, you've also been involved with snooker, I gather.
Yeah, we had some fun with snooker. I don't know if Coral quite found it that way. But it was my first meet-up with Harry Findlay in 1990 at the Wembley, the Benson and Hedges, as it was known then. Small field, as you probably know, 16 runners, and they played through 4 or 5 nights during the week there. Great competition, good atmosphere at Wembley, and Coral had their booth. They were in charge of betting there. And I went along there one day to make sure everything was all right, and Harry was about. And Harry got introduced to me, and I got introduced to him. And he fancied Tony Knowles to beat Terry Griffiths on the day. And Jimmy White, I think, was playing Tony Meehan, I'm not sure. But they were both small prices. But he fancied a horse running at Huntingdon in a maiden hurdle the next day and wanted a price from the office. So I rang him up. And I think 2-5, Knowles, and 4-11, Jimmy White. So wouldn't have paid a lot of money without this horse. Never been out, complete maiden field. He wanted 2-1 about it. Our guys down there offered him 11-8, which he took. Supposedly, frustratingly took. Well, the two snooker players wiped the balls clean very quickly. The horse opened the next day at 4-6. quickly went 1-2, 4 to 9-2 to 5, and they never saw which way it went. And Harry was laughing once again all the way to the bank. It was the first of a lot of meetings I had with him. And of course, you'll know from previous Star Sports interviews and whatever, Hackney Wick was one of his favourite haunts, and used to see him a lot down there on Saturday mornings. It was a wonderful venue, a wonderful atmosphere down there. I don't know what health and safety would make of the kitchens in terms of their bacon butties and whatever these days, but it was a lot of fun. And that's where I got close to the Power organisation. And I started working with Tom. Tom was basically the greyhound man. John was more into flat race, into the horse racing. But of course, he'd come off the rails a few times for his misadventures on course. But Tom and I worked together, and then he was doing the tissue, the coupon at West Ham. It was a basic tissue in those days. Nobody talked about who was going to score the first goals or correct scores and whatever. And that's where I jumped in and told him some of the ideas I had, which he liked. And we teamed up for quite a while for, you know, giving punters a little bit more than what was open to them in those days. But getting back to the snooker, I was in the office one day when I think it was Silvino, Francisco, was playing rather than his nephew Peter. And there was something going off on snooker frame betting. And what should have been an 8-1 chance quickly went down to 5s and 4s. And there was buzzing all over the place. And I answered the phone to one of our big punters. And I said, well, look, this was an 8-1 chance now. It's now 7-2. He said, well, if you give me even money, I'll have it. And that's how crooked that snooker match was. And there was another one not long afterwards either. I think one of them played Tony Meo, quote Tony again. Correct score on the World Championship, this was a 10-2 scoreline. Everybody and his cat wanted it, and they got it, and the score was 10-2. And that period of snooker was indelibly printed in my mind that it's not quite the game, or wasn't as professional as it should have been at that time.
Tell us a bit more about your involvement with the tote that you mentioned.
Yes, I decided to take the work that I'd done for Corals, which got me the job, because I was working a lot on the place pot at that time. It was my favourite bet, still is in many ways. And I went to people there. It's when I first met Joe McNally, who's a great mate. And I know the person behind the other side of this camera should be ever grateful to him, because it was he, along with one other person, who invented the Scoop 6. Name was Joe McNally. He went on to be the ghostwriter for Richard Pittman for all those thrillers. And Joe is a great mate to this day. Joe set up a little company called Lazy Bet, and I'll go into that very soon. But for the time being, with the tote, yeah, I used their office basically to get all the information I could, all the stats and facts for the place pot, which has been running for some time now. And I met up with Lord Wyatt of Weeford to give him his correct title, and it was Lord Wyatt that brought the bet over from South Africa, which not many people knew about. And he became a great, you know, a good friend, and he wrote the foreword for the first book that I wrote in the PlaySpot series, which I wrote three books for. And that was in 1994. And the whole situation with the tote just went on for a very long time, to the point where I was invited to their 25th lunch to celebrate the PlaySpot, and stood up on the podium and gave him my two penny worth about the place pot. And of course, that's what I write predominantly about for the Sporting Life, so things were about to change for me quite a lot. But the previous year to that, I'd taken the football situation further, and I wrote my first book, which was the first book ever written on fixed odds football betting. At least I'm pretty sure it was. That's what the publisher told me. And that went very well, extremely well. And it was the first of 10 books I've had published. Great to see your book in WH Smith when your school have told you that you're a waste of space. Haven't made a lot of money on them. We can't all be JK Rowlings, but it's something I put my heart and soul into, and that's what the publisher knew. And I think the readers saw how much work went into it, and that's the type of work I do today. I don't like idle people. I haven't got a lot of time for them. There's a lot of idle people in racing who spout off in the media about what they do and don't know. One of them, if I can just give you an example, is the effect of the draw and this nonsense business that comes up now, where they're saying it all depends where the pace in the race is. Well, of course it does to a fashion, but I'm afraid I've got facts and figures that can absolutely bury them in some of the big races as to where the bias is. And they do their best to try and hide behind the pace because they can't be bothered to do the work themselves. They're not willing to put the spade work in. And it's very easy to say, well, there's no pace in that race, so obviously the result wasn't exactly predictable, but I'm afraid it was. We had the Cambridgeshire just a little while ago. Five of the last seven have won in large figures, and this year's was a triumph because everyone was talking about the low draw. Well, the 50-1 winner won from trap 2020 it was, I think, and the horse in third place was from 22. The horse was won with a 50-1 chance, and in the Lincoln earlier this year, the horse in question, Dolphin Vista, I think it was my first tip for the Lincoln itself. It finished fifth, so all monies weren't lost. Bookmakers paying a lot out on the fifth place. And it duly obliged in the Cambridgeshire at 50-1 from a draw which was advantageous, let's put it that way.
Okay, so as well as all these other things, you already told us there's been several ventures that you've gone into. Can you tell us about them and how they were successful or maybe how they weren't?
Yeah, sure. I think anything that I've done myself, let's start with a jigsaw puzzle which I made from Desert Orchid. I got hold of Herbert Whittaker at the track one day and said how much would it be to cost me to get the rights on one of the pictures of Desi, and I got hold of it and made this jigsaw, which was very nice. It was nicely produced and all the rest of it, and I got on the television with Derek Thompson. I can't think of the exact year now, but we were on there on Boxing Day. And, you know, life's got a funny way of kicking you in the teeth at the time, because all the great races that Desi ran on the day that I took the picture up there and we got exposure and whatever, he fell at the third last. and that was that, really. In the end, I had them all stocked up in a garage, and a trader from Reading, who I've got to know in different ways, big guy in markets, and he took them all off me. So it was a no-lose situation, but it wasn't quite the dream I made it. There was the time as well in 1994 when I had a shop in Kent, in betting shop. I went back into the betting shop business. And my publisher, Ian Mills at Oldcastle Books, he assured me that the lottery was coming and I should be careful how much money I put into various ventures. I ignored him, like I do, and went in there in the March, had three disastrous big races, and first of which was Martin Pike winning the Grand National with Minnie Homer, Freddie Starr's horse, which of course was very well publicised, and that went off at 16-1 and took most of my money with it. Just about recovered, I suppose, until the Derby, when the 7-2 favourite Erhab trotted up. It was Willie Carson's fourth win. How can a horse win the Derby when it's had six races as a juvenile? It doesn't happen. Only won two of those. Comes up and wins the Derby at 7-2, any which way you like. And then there was the wonderful 40-1 St Ledger winner that Pat Eddery rode that September. And of course, Win McCrick jumping up and down that the bookmakers have had a wonderful day and the punters have all lost their money. Well, not in my shop, they didn't. I don't know if they were related to Pat Eddery or not, but that was disastrous. And 3 weeks later, the lottery started, the National Lottery, and that was it. I didn't make another Christmas.
So you touched on earlier greyhound racing. You can elaborate a bit more into how much involvement you've had with that.
Yeah, well, when the shop went belly up in 94, I was wondering which way to turn. And the Greyhound Stadium at Sittingbourne was beginning to hit the headlines, and whether it was going to open, it wasn't going to open, and I'll come on to that in a moment. But before then, I used the permit that I had to wangle my way into Ramsgate, which still had about 8 months, I think, left of its lifeline, although we didn't know that at the time. Yeah, I stood up there with three other bookmakers, and I had a guy there that I worked with, Terry, who could charm the birds off the tree. And we didn't really have enough money. We certainly didn't have enough qualification to stand there in terms of what she wanted for licenses and all the rest of it. But Terry only had to go and buy her a drink, and she never asked too many times after that. But cut long story short, Ramsgate closed eventually, as I say, and so I moved up the road, as it were, to Sittingbourne, and I went to meet the guys up there. The track wasn't in a good way in the early days. I know it's a decent venue now, but the times the hair broke down there, you couldn't believe it. But I wangled my way in as a reserve commentator there. I'd never commentated on anything in my life, but I had dinner one night with the racing manager, who's still there, to my knowledge, and I became a steward and did the commentating, and that lasted for as long as my next venture, and we went and we parted our ways. But it was a good bit of fun, a good bit of experience, and if you don't go knocking on doors, they can't be opened.
Lazy Bet. Now, there's a name that appeals to a punter like me that only backs what other people tells him. Is that an inspired name? Was it an inspired venture?
It was an inspired venture by Joe McNally, who's the ex-marketing director of the Tote. And he, if Andrew Mount, who I know that you've done videos with, should be forever grateful to Joe, because he, along with one other guy, invented the Scoop 6. Lovely man, Joe. Got so much experience in the business. And so much of it was wasted, I'm afraid, in the later days of the Tote. They didn't acknowledge the genius that they had, in all honesty. But Joe decided to create Lazy Bet, and it was based really on the 10 to follow. And basically the idea was that you sent a certain amount of money. I've forgotten how much it was now. Joe did all that side of it. But basically you were funding into a massive syndicate to try and win this great prize. And it was up to me basically to assemble the horses, along with a friend called Simon, and we picked our horses. Two massive results went against us, really. We had on, let's put it this way, on Christmas Eve, as I remember, we had all the positions from second right through to about 28th. We were second, third, fourth, right the way through to 28th on Christmas Eve. And we were looking forward to the Tingle Creek chase because Simon, and with Joe's backing, decided that World Chief was the underrated horse of the year. Yes, he had some great horses to run up against, Zertiop and the Irish horse, of course, which won the Tingle Creek, but gave us a great run. There was a lot of interest in that, but the real killer was on Champion Hurdle Day, when Archibald, the great Archibald, came to win his race. It was only a matter of time when they put his head in front of the line, but he didn't want to go past Hardy Eustace, not in a million years. And there, to a fashion, died Lazy Bet on that day. It was a great venture. And there's still talk that we might resurrect something between us. Joe is not a quitter in life. And that story may not be dead.
For the latest political betting news and odds, check in with our expert William Kajani at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.